The Audible is presented by Trader Joe's. Discover more about Trader Joe's by listening to their podcast, Inside Trader Joe's, available wherever you get your podcasts. And also, with the Super Bowl coming up, be sure to get your salsa at Trader Joe's. They have the best salsa of any store I know.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague from The Athletic, Stuart Mandel. We are taping this a few hours after Stu's hometown favorite team, the Bengals. The Bengals are going to the Super Bowl. It only took Joe Burrow 2 years to do the unthinkable. Stu, are you hungover?
I'm not hungover, but I'm pretty excited. I'm not going to lie. It's just crazy how quickly this went from after they got the monkey off their back and won the first playoff game. I remember thinking, hey, wouldn't it be cool if they went to the Super Bowl? Not actually thinking that was a remote possibility. And at 21-3 yesterday, didn't think they were going to the Super Bowl either, but here we are. I thought for a second there would be another Bengals 49ers Super Bowl, but instead it's... So it's my hometown team against your current hometown team at the Rams Stadium. You going to be there?
I would like to be. I don't think I have that kind of juice. It's not a Fox game. And the guys I know, I can't say, hey, I know you only get a certain amount of tickets for the Super Bowl. Hook me up. No. So it's interesting just as like seeing the game now also through my kid's eyes. He is a huge Rams fan, but he's also a huge Ja'Marr Chase fan. So, best case scenario for him.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So, best case scenario for him. Yeah, John Hayes, our producer, we were talking about it beforehand. You know, in college, 21-3 is not an insurmountable deficit by any... Like, 17 points, I don't think of in college as... You see comebacks of by that much or more. I don't want to say all the time, but it's not that unusual. So, it kind of caught me by surprise that that was the record. For a NFL playoff comeback, or at least a conference championship comeback. I didn't think they were out of it at 21-3, but what blows my mind is that the Chiefs looked unstoppable in the first half up until the last play of the first half, and then did nothing on offense the whole rest of the
game.
Yeah,
I thought the Bengals defensive line, they have two good edge rushers, and they got after them, and I thought their D-line played well, and it was just, you know, look, I mean, I'm still watching it thinking, you know, this is Pat Mahomes. It's so tough to win. Like, that's one of the toughest home field advantages that anyone has, and to see the Bengals do it was pretty remarkable. It was not Patrick Mahomes' certainly his best game by any stretch, and it just felt like at one point I think he was like 14 of 16 with a drop. And then it was almost like they can do no wrong. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, it wasn't like the Bengals had it going. And then it just in the second half, just it was like a flip, you know, a switch got flipped. And, you know, again, I keep coming back to all the Joe Burrow stuff that I'd seen back in, you know, obviously it's different to do it in the SEC or in college football compared to the NFL. But it is just remarkable that everything kind of like the momentum that he had. I mean, remember, he's coming off an injury that was a significant injury last off season, so it wasn't like he had a full rookie season. Their offensive line is shaky, although I think they played pretty well relative to what they are. You know, he got sacked a ton of times last week, and this week he was able to hold up, or they were able to hold up for him. And I thought, you know, it's just a... It's just crazy to think that they are here this soon. Like, it doesn't surprise me that he's led him to a Super Bowl, but to think that he's led him to a Super Bowl within 2 years is, it's just, it keeps coming back to the word remarkable.
You found, last night you were texting us, you found, and I got to be honest, I don't even remember barely doing this, but during the early months of the pandemic when we were desperate for any content, you, me, and Andy Staples did a live group text of watching the first round of the draft that year, the Burrow year. And you asked us, you opened it to the floor and said, what's the over-under Burrow?
No, I think I said the over-under was 50% Burrow leads the Bengals to the Super Bowl.
And Andy and I were both like, uh-uh. Like, we love Joe Burrow, but it's the Bengals. So good for him overcoming that. I got to say, though, the defense won them the game yesterday. I mean, Joe Burrow, nothing against Joe Burrow. He did what he had to do, but I have a bone to pick with Tony Romo. He, at no point in the second half, did he make any attempt to tell us what the Bengals had changed defensively. Because clearly they had changed something major to be able to, you know, suddenly the receiver, I mean, in the first half, Travis Kelce, it looked like he was going to go off for, he was going to catch 20 balls or something. And then Mahomes, nobody's open. That's how he got sacked, you know, those back-to-back plays at the end of regulation. Only hours later on Twitter, you know, from some NFL writers, do I see some actual stats about, oh, they started dropping eight into coverage more, and they changed to cover one. At no point during the actual game did they attempt to explain that, but that was the difference. Okay, let's not go 20 minutes on the NFL this week. What do you say?
Fair enough. All right, Stu, there is a bunch of stuff that has gone on in college football. As we are, I don't know, about an hour ago, this became official. It had been rumblings over the weekend. Auburn had hired Austin Davis. A lot of our college football diehards will remember him as a terrific quarterback at Southern Miss not that long ago. He was coaching for Pete Carroll as a quarterback coach with the Seahawks. Took Auburn's offensive coordinator job just a few weeks ago. And over the weekend, it was coming over rumblings. It was not going well. He was not comfortable there. And it became official. He put out a statement, announced that he was stepping down. And, you know, for the reasons, I think they were very personal reasons. Wanted to spend more time with his family. And from some of the calls I made this morning, you know, were in line with that and just felt like, you know, he didn't want to, you know, it's a tough grind, and he did not want to enter into it and let anybody else down, because it's, you know, it's just a hard job. And so what's, you know, in the context of that, look, all these situations are different. I don't want to say they're all the exact same for his reasons for stepping down compared to Derek Mason, who, from our reporting, was leaving Auburn, whether he was getting the Oklahoma State defensive coordinator job or not. No, he ended up becoming the Oklahoma State defensive coordinator. But you've had a lot of turnover and a lot of turbulence in Brian Harsin's first year on the job at Auburn. So I think we need to at least talk about that a little bit here.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the offseason got off to a kind of a eyebrow-raising start when Bo Nix transferred, because here's this legacy Auburn guy who has been synonymous with the team for the last 3 years, and you're like, huh, he's transferring? But then I didn't think much of it after that. Then you find out that Derek Mason wants out, you know, very well-respected defensive coordinator, and he leaves for Oklahoma State, which it's debatable whether that's a lateral move, a move down, however you want to put it. I mean, Oklahoma State was certainly a better team last season. And now this. If you think back, I definitely was a little bit surprised when they hired Brian Harsin. Not that he was very successful at Boise State, so it wasn't like, oh, he's not qualified for the job. It just kind of seemed out of nowhere. You always thought if Brian Harsin left Boise State, it would be for a West Coast job, not an SEC job. And then he got off to a decent start. They were 6-2 at one point. And then it just, you know, they lost their last five. Now this is going on. And certainly at a place like Auburn, not a lot of patience. You know, I think the best thing for Brian Harsin is that their basketball team is so good right now. And the Auburn fans are a little bit distracted enjoying having the number one basketball team in the country. Otherwise, it would be just a meltdown, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right with that. I mean, Brian Harsin, from all accounts that I've heard, hasn't really endeared himself to a lot of key people there. And it was an interesting situation how he got hired. Alan Green, the AD, who hasn't been there that long. I mean, that was a hire he really pushed for. I think there was some pushback on it. As you said, they're number one in the country in basketball, and they just locked up Bruce Pearl for a long time. So all of a sudden now it's like everything's going well but football.
And they've got SUNY
Elite. Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of good things. It's just right now for football, which is obviously the sport they all hang, you know, they care about most.
Yeah.
It's just very turbulent. You also, you know, they have a new president that needs to get hired at some point. There's just a lot of stuff going on. And, I mean, the thing with Brian Harsin is there has, you know, I think he was a curious hire. As you said, like, you know, people thought he would have a chance in the Pac-12. And some of those openings, like, he was not, you know, he was not an attractive candidate for a couple of the Pac-12 openings in the past. And so I think this was a big job that he jumped on. And, you know, we'll see if he can get it turned around. I mean, it's also worth noting that they've had a bunch of really good defensive linemen go in the portal. And it's not just the coordinators. There's been a lot of staff turnover in a short amount of time. So we'll see if, you know, we'll see what some of the new hires do. We'll see, obviously, what else. I mean, there's so much transition in the conference right now, and that's the one. You know, you look at what that division is. We obviously know what Alabama is, and then you have Ole Miss with Lane Kiffin is cleaning up in the portal, and we'll talk about that in a second. But he definitely has that program trending upward. You have Arkansas, which I feel like has had a terrific offseason, you know, off the field with the portal, and some of the hires they've made I think have been really good. And so I think that's trending in a good place. You have Texas A&M with the number one ranked recruiting class there. You have LSU with Brian Kelly, and we'll get to that in a minute. And there's definitely that's gotten interesting. And you have Leach, who's like, actually has probably done better than both of us thought he would do so far. And so, you know, if you're Auburn, I think you are realizing it feels very tenuous right now.
As somebody in our Slack channel, company Slack channel pointed out, how different would this whole situation be if Tank Bigsby stays in bounds in the Iron Bowl long enough for them to win that, run out the clock and win that game? They had that game won. And if he wins the Iron Bowl in his first season, against, I don't remember what Alabama was ranked at that time, but very high, I think everybody would love Brian Harsin right now. But they blew that game. They finished 6-7. Half the coaching staff has turned over already. Coordinators are stepping down under bizarre circumstances. So basically, I think in the cutthroat culture of the SEC, basically he's got to win this year, or I wouldn't be surprised at all if he's a 2-0.
No, as you said, Auburn is more volatile than any leadership spot. And I agree. I mean, I think he's going to enter the season on a very hot seat for year two.
You mentioned a couple other SEC West coaches who are in the news this week. Maybe, I wouldn't say in the news, on social media. Brian Kelly did another one of his dance videos with a recruit. That made the rounds. Again, it just seems like he had some sort of personality transplant when he moved from South Bend to Baton Rouge. And what was interesting is one of his, you know, rival coaches now, Lane Kiffin, kind of mocked it on Twitter. And then over the weekend, he also, I guess this is Jackson Dart, I think.
Before we get to Jackson Dart, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
What did you think when you saw the video? Just purely, what went through your mind when you saw the Brian Kelly, this latest, I think it went up Friday night, and he is, you know, he is dancing, I don't know if I want to call it provocatively, I don't know, I mean, it's just like, you know, he's close to the recruit, and it's, just say what you're going to,
it was
say
awkward. What you're gonna, yeah. Just use the word awkward. Look, he looks like a guy who's trying to be cool, he's trying to do what he thinks is going to be cool to recruits. And by the way, you know, it's kind of like how fans used to make fun of the ugly college football uniforms. And like, why are they doing it? Because the recruits like it. They love those jerseys. Like I got, the recruit wouldn't have posted that if he didn't think it was really cool. So he's trying to be cool to the recruits, but the rest of us are looking at it going, what is going on with this guy? This is not the guy from Notre Dame. I don't know if maybe he always wanted to dance and you're not allowed to there or something. Or this is a newfound a newfound skill.
Like, you know, a couple things. So somebody I know at LSU had pointed out to me, hey, that thing got 5 million views. And so, you know, if it's a recruit and the recruit thinks, hey, Brian Kelly got me 5 million views, does that make him more likely to want to sign up and play for LSU? Is that like, is it go back to the, I don't know, it's P.T. Barnum line, is like, there's no such, maybe I'm misquoting the wrong person. Like, there's no such thing as bad publicity. I don't know if it fits into that category, if that's how Brian Kelly certainly views it. Like, there's been a couple of odd things that Brian Kelly has done since taking the job. Some of the dancing thing, to me, this, like, the only thing that...
At the end of the day, it's pretty harmless.
That's what I was going to say. The only thing that I was like, I am curious about, and I don't know if we've ever gotten like an answer on it, maybe we have and I missed it, but which is the whole, he's at the basketball game and he's doing the mock Southern accent over the top and he, family, you know, that. Like, was that just a joke that just fell completely flat that, like, you know, or whatever? Because I think if you take that out and it's just, hey, here's a 60-year-old guy, you know, being silly, and that's okay. And all this stuff is silly anyway. The photo shoots that happen in recruiting now, and now the circle dance. I don't know. Like, I think it's, I as you said, I think it's harmless. I think it's silly. I think the curious thing will be, like, you know, people are gonna say, well, is this, you know, is this his personality coming out? Is he just having fun with it? Like, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, if recruits buy it, if recruits decide, hey, I want to be a part of this because this looks like it's just fun and that's that, and this is how Brian Kelly is evolving or whatever, it's like, if it works for him, it works for him, you know, or whatever. And so I thought the Lane Kiffin thing, because Lane has been very effective at using social media to reinvent himself to some degree, and I think Lane Kiffin kind of poking Brian Kelly in the way he did, even to the scent on Monday where he had that graphic, which I thought was kind of funny, where it was like, you know, it's Lane and it's the portal, instead of the Lion King, it's the Portal King, with, you know, it looks like a, you know, an actual tiger though, that he's got in front of him. I don't know if that's his way of
You think that was intentional, the tiger part?
I do, because they had some back and forth on that, and I mean, that's how I would read it, because it's like, it's a tiger, it's nothing else, right? So.
On Friday, after the dance video makes the rounds, Lane quote tweets it and says, "Did you lose a bet or something, Coach Brian Kelly? This can't be real. Photoshop, account hacked." I mean, it was pretty aggressive. You know, it wasn't just like light mockery. It was, it seemed pretty aggressive. And then, you know how some coaches say, "Oh, I don't pay any attention to the recruiting rankings. You know, we evaluate the class ourselves. We don't care if they're recruiting." No, Lane's not one of those. He definitely tweeted after the Jackson Dart and, his tight end Michael Trigg, after those two became official.
He just got another big recruit this morning from Georgia Tech, who's a former four-star defensive lineman who's a good player, Jared Ivey. So he has been very, very effective in gobbling up good transfers.
And he took a screenshot. So he took a screenshot of Ole Miss number one with 10 commits on the team portal rankings on 24/7, and then the Portal King graphic. Remember, Max Olson was on here a couple weeks ago and was saying how he thinks, you know, as this evolves, some coaches will brand their school as this is a transfer portal school, and it sure seems like Lane is embracing the heck out of the transfer portal. In fact, last year they got some guys from the portal last year that turned out to be some of their best defensive players, like Chance Campbell from Maryland.
You know who is not in the portal at all right now still?
Most college football players? No, who?
Jim Harbaugh in Michigan.
Not yet.
No, I'm saying no. Michigan is not active in the portal at all. I'm not saying with a Jim.
Oh.
Like,
I thought you meant he himself being in the transfer
portal. No, we'll see where that goes this week. But, you know, here's the thing. So it's been reported by The Athletic and other places that he has had talks with the Minnesota Vikings for their coaching vacancy. He has worked with their new GM. you know, there's a Miami Dolphins piece to this that is curious, just because when Stephen Ross, the owner there, who's a huge Michigan booster, had fired the head coach, Brian Flores, that he ended up basically, you know, putting out a statement that Jim Harbaugh is not going to be part of this. And now that you're starting to hear back channel that, you know what, if Jim Harbaugh is open to leaving, I'd rather have him here than someplace else. Now, I don't know if that's the gospel or not. We'll see if they're, you know, where there's at. And now, as I've reported for The Athletic for weeks now, the sources I've talked to at Michigan think if Jim Harbaugh can get a job, he's going to take a job, that he wants back into the NFL. Now, this is what else we can add. They did have a recruiting weekend this weekend. They had a junior day on Sunday where I guess there was like two dozen juniors. So it's not like, you know, it's like there's different stuff going on right now. You know, you have the NFL part of it, and then you have him at least trying to keep some semblance of what's going on as a college program. But they're not active in the portal. He has to replace defensive coordinator Mike McDonald, who left to go back to his brother's staff with the Ravens. So it's a very interesting time for Michigan, coming off, you know, as we said, the first time they won a Big Ten title in 17 years. So we'll see what happens.
Your initial reports have been focused on the Raiders. I think the notable thing here is just that he's taking the interviews.
The thing that people have said was that he would be interested in taking, you know, in going back. And these are the guys.
And that's the difference from, there was, you know, several years there, once he got to Michigan, where every year there were rumors, is he going to go back to the NFL? But nothing ever came of it. The fact that he actually interviewed with the Vikings, you know, confirms what you're saying, that it seems like he's very open to returning if somebody wants to offer him a job. And to the Dolphins part of it, you know, what we'd always heard is Stephen Ross is such a big Michigan fan that he doesn't want to mess with their program. He doesn't want to, you know, take Jim Harbaugh away from them. But if Jim Harbaugh is going to leave anyway, well, then, hey, you know, why not here?
No, and we'll see if it actually gets to that point. I'm interested on that part of it, but, you know.
I don't know if we should wait a week. No, let's just go ahead and do it now. If he takes an NFL job, who is your clubhouse leader to be the next coach of Michigan?
You know, at one point I would have thought this might be a job that Matt Rhule would try to get out of the NFL to jump on. I don't know if the timing has changed there. He's made some, you know, I think as of this weekend, he just hired a new offensive line coach, not to say that he couldn't have made that move. You know, we've mentioned Matt Campbell for other jobs. That's definitely a bigger job than what he has right now. And you know, I know that they didn't have a great year, but I still think he would be a really good hire for there. I think those guys would be really, really high on the list.
Yeah. It's an interesting situation about, you know, AD Ward Manuel have to decide, do I want to promote from within and just kind of keep things the way they are, but without Jim Harbaugh, or do I go out and get the best guy possible? And I think Michigan is such a big job that it would, I don't know, in some ways be kind of a wasted opportunity not to try to go out and get a Matt Rhule or a Matt Campbell.
Yeah, I mean, right now the one guy on staff who would be viable, Josh Gattis, the offensive coordinator, who, by the way, just won the Biletnikoff Award. He's been up for several head coaching
jobs.
Did
you say the Biletnikoff Award?
I don't know if they would. Did I actually just say that? Sorry. Let me repeat that. The one guy who would probably be viable internally for the Michigan job is offensive coordinator Josh Gattis, who just won the Broyles Award, given to the nation's top assistant. He's been up for several head coaching jobs before. It wouldn't shock me if they went in that direction, but we'll see. Obviously, a bunch of dominoes have to fall for Jim Harbaugh to be leaving to create that vacancy.
So just to circle back real quick on the portal, we mentioned Jackson Dart in passing. But that is a pretty significant, you know, they're losing Matt Corral. Lane Kiffin, obviously known for grooming quarterbacks. He has clearly decided that Jackson Dart was the guy to get of the various notable quarterbacks that entered the portal. You're there in LA, around USC. What is Ole Miss getting?
They're getting a talented quarterback who runs well. The ball jumps out of his hand. There's a lot of work to be done. He's still a young quarterback, right? I think that this is going to be an interesting project. You know, we had him in the game late in the year against UCLA, where he did some good things. He did some not so good things, right? You know, I think he's got talent. He was a guy that I think that USC was hoping at the end of the year, at least USC brass, was that he was going to shine and that he was going to make the job that much more attractive to whoever wants to. Yeah, we don't have a lot of other pieces, but we have a potential first round quarterback here. Obviously, it's gone in a bunch of different directions where, you know, they ended up getting the big coach, and they're probably getting the big coach's old quarterback.
Are we still sure about that?
What's moving on? We're pretty confident.
Even after the Bobby Engram becomes official in Wisconsin?
I will still be very, very surprised if Caleb Williams does not end up as a USC Trojan.
I thought another really notable transfer portal transaction was Colorado running back, former Colorado running back, Jarek Broussard, going to Michigan State, which obviously had great success in the portal last year with getting Kenneth Walker from Wake Forest. I don't know that a lot of people outside the Pac-12 are even familiar with Jarek Broussard, but in 2020, the COVID year, he was Pac-12 Offensive Player of the Year and had some really, really big games. 187 yards against UCLA, 301 yards against Arizona. Granted, that was a terrible Arizona team. Not quite as productive this past season. Colorado itself was not particularly productive, but still he had a 151-yard game against Oregon State and 108-yard game against UCLA. So he's going to Michigan State. I'm not going to just hand him the job, but certainly you would think he's got a really good chance to become their primary running back and become a very successful running back. They also got Jalen Berger from Wisconsin. So Mel Tucker, another solid job out of the portal.
It's interesting. I would have thought Jalen Berger would have been the guy more, even like Broussard was, like you said, he was good in a couple of years ago. I don't know. I think because of the success Kenneth Walker had, we're kind of like, okay, you know, who's going to be the next one? And they have two good options here.
They do, and I'm not guaranteeing that either of them replicates what Kenneth Walker did. But, I mean, 2020 Jarek Broussard was one of the best running backs in the country. So he's got that in him. He's frankly more proven to this point in his career than Kenneth Walker was, who had been kind of a part-time player at Wake Forest. Let's get to some emails.
As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com.
Yeah, so we almost forgot to mention it's signing day Wednesday. That is kind of February signing day is going to become anticlimactic because of the December signing day. But it's pretty notable usually for schools that just hired a new coach. And so Tom and Del Rey, hey guys, Miami's currently ranked 39th in the country in the 2022 recruiting rankings. That's already significantly better than they were 2 months ago when Cristobal first took the helm at Miami. True or false, Miami finishes top 15 in the 2022 class. Bonus true or false, Miami wins the Coastal this year.
I think they have a better chance of winning the Coastal than I think they have of winning, finishing top 15 at this point, because they have a lot of ground to cover. They do have some big fish out there, most notably a local product, Shamar Stewart, who's a big defensive lineman. He's a five-star guy. He plays at Pace, and it's basically, my understanding is between them and A&M. He visited there this past weekend. Now, what's tricky is Mario Cristobal has made almost no hires on his staff. He has no offensive coordinator. He has no defensive coordinator. And so, like, there's a few linemen that my understanding is they're expected to commit to them. One of them is a four-star who's also from the Pacific Northwest, is a highly regarded offensive lineman. And then there's a few other players that I know they're in the mix for, but, like, there's another five-star offensive tackle from Seattle that my understanding is he won't sign or announce for maybe another couple of months. So there's that. My guess is even if they get Stewart, And a couple of these guys, I just don't think they would be able to vault that high up to get in the top 15.
But whether they do or not, here, so sometimes with these recruiting rankings, you got to look at, because the class sizes vary so much. Miami only has 10 commitments, and 9 of them are 4-stars, which is pretty good. So, yes, they're 38th in the overall rankings as of this recording, but their average is average per player score is 92.86, which would put them in the top 10. You know, it's not as high as A&M, Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, Texas, but it's slightly higher than Notre Dame, who's sitting at number 7, higher than Michigan, higher than UNC, Oklahoma, Clemson. So, yes, they have a higher average recruit ranking right now than Clemson. So it's really the class size that's keeping them behind.
Yeah, one thing Mario has done pretty well so early was he's done well on the portal. Henry Parrish, who's a good change of pace back from Ole Miss, he's coming back. He's a South Florida kid. He's coming back. Frank Ladson, who came into Clemson as a big, you know, with a big reputation, we'll see how well he does when, you know, his new stop. Antonio Moultrie was a very productive D lineman at UAB, especially late in the season. Jake Lichtenstein was at USC, was a pretty productive D lineman. They needed help on the D line. Those are two guys who will come in immediately and I think help them out. And then what I think that area he has addressed well. Cyrus Moss is a top 75 recruit from Vegas. He's coming there. They think he'll be a big time edge rusher. And Nigel Lee Kelly was, I think, really his first big get when he got the job as a top 100 player from Dillard, which has produced a ton of players over the year. And like, that helps. They need those guys. But obviously, if they could get Shamar Stewart, that would be the headline guy for this class. Look, I have no doubt Mario Cristobal is going to kill it on the recruiting front. It, you know, it may show up more, you know, certainly a year from now than it will this week, but it wouldn't shock me if he had a big surprise and you know, landed a big, you know, big get this week that would, you know, people wouldn't have expected coming, you know, 2 months
ago. The question is, who's he waiting on for those coordinator jobs? Is it somebody from the Bengals or the Rams? Because there's not many people left you have to wait out.
But there's actually a lot of dominoes that are like tilting right now on the NFL, you know, assistant coach front. And I think there's a lot of pieces. Like, for instance, you know, one of the guys I know he was interested in was Ken Dorsey, former Miami Gray quarterback, who's now the pass game coordinator with the Bills. In all likelihood, Ken Dorsey's going to be an offensive coordinator, whether it's with the Bills or follow Brian Daboll to the Giants. So I don't think he's coming back to college, right? But there are a few other pieces like that. I know Mario is still talking to people and talking to candidates, because I heard from different people who are like, I don't think I'm going to do that. But I think there's, you know, he's still having these conversations.
Brian Daboll, by the way, what a amazing last 5 years he's had. I don't remember having even known who he was before Saban hired him. And he was only there for that one season. But he, you know, goes down in history as the guy who called the play on 2nd and 26 that Tua threw the game-winning touchdown. And that was it. One and done there. Goes to the Bills. Is you know, plays a huge role in Josh Allen's emergence. And now he's a head coach. That's quite a rise in the last 5 years.
Yeah, the one NFL game I did was a Bills game. It was Josh Allen's rookie year. And fortunately, like our crew, Brady Quinn knows Brian Daboll probably as well as he knows any coach, because he worked with him at, I think, at least 2 different places. And so, you know, I got to see a side of Brian Daboll that I never knew existed, you know, because I wasn't around him hardly at all at, you know, at Alabama. It's not like the coordinators are readily available either. And he was only there a year. But he was, you know, he was fun to be around. He was very self-effacing. He had, you know, he's been an interesting guy to pick his brain over time since, you know, kind of getting that relationship a little bit. So we'll see. Obviously, Joe Judge, who was another guy who had Alabama ties from his days as a assistant in the SEC, it didn't work out there at all. Daboll obviously is further along in his NFL coaching career, and as you said, he did a terrific job with the Bills, and we'll see if he can get the Giants going.
My only interaction with him was after the national title game. I remember, in the locker room, I remember he was at first nervous that he was breaking Nick Saban's rules if he talked to us, but everybody is available after the playoff games. And then, yeah, just being like, you know, we were just all asking about that play call. And in fact, I remember asking him, me personally, about Devontae Smith, who had barely played at that point. Like, how did he end up being the guy that caught the pass? And he was just so nonchalant about it. Like, well, it was his number. I mean, it was his time. So, okay, that was quite tangent.
All right, Stu, this question from Chad Justice in Raleigh. There have been some talk amongst your colleagues about Kirby Smart being the second best coach in college. Really? We're snubbing Dabo? Who is our colleagues who are doing that?
I guess there is some talk of him maybe passing Dabo. We haven't really gotten into that yet.
Okay. This got me wondering, though, how many college coaches do you think could win a title at the right program, using Georgia as an example with its massive fan base and fertile recruiting ground? For example, could a Kirk Ferentz, playing a similar style of football, be able to win a title at Georgia with the boost in recruiting? How many coaches do you think could win a title there by year six?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. The Kirk Ferentz example, of all the coaches to use, it's almost impossible to project that one because I'm so used to him winning with two stars, three stars, no stars. And obviously Kirby just won with a whole bunch of five stars. I think that it's not giving Kirby Smart enough credit to think that we could take 10, 15, 20 coaches, plop them in there, and they would do the same thing. You still got to have the right coach, because there are plenty of programs with similar pieces as Georgia who...
You're talking resources.
Resources, recruiting territory, size of the stadium, history, and they haven't had that kind of success in a long time. Texas being a prime example, Florida being an example. You got to have the right coach. And I mean, I wouldn't have guessed back when Steve Spurrier was, or even when Urban Meyer was at Florida, that they would hit a point where they were just churning through, you know, failed coach after failed coach after failed coach. That seemed like one of those places where, you know, you could just, why wouldn't you win big at Florida, given where it is? Certainly when Mack Brown had to go into Texas, we would not have guessed they would go more than a decade, just complete mediocrity. So I don't know. In terms of a number, that doesn't mean there aren't other really good coaches out there besides Kirby Smart. I just don't know what the number is. I don't think it's as high a number as maybe he's thinking.
No, I think it's a pretty small number. I think you wouldn't be giving Kirby Smart enough credit. I think it is incredibly hard to win a college football national title. Now, it'll probably get easier if Nick Saban leaves, but right now it is incredibly hard. And you know how I know it's incredibly hard? Because very few guys who are college coaches now have actually done it, right? You know, like, if we were to go down, and we'll do this exercise probably in the next month or so, but like, who we think our best coaches are, realistically, almost none of these guys have actually come close to winning a national title, right? You know, Brian Kelly, who you and I both had as a top three head coach, he's been to the playoff. He's never come close to winning a national title. Just because you got to the playoff, those weren't close games.
Let's try this. Right? Name me a coach at a program that is not a national title contender ever, but who you think's really good, that you think if that guy had the Georgia job, he could win the national title there.
I'm going to twist that a little. I'm going to name you a coach who I think is really good, who I think if he had another job, not as similar to that, but like, I think of surroundings, like, I think Kyle Whittingham is a really, really good coach. I think if Kyle Whittingham had gotten the USC job somewhere in the last decade, I think he would have had a chance to win a national title.
That's interesting. So you hesitate to plop him at Georgia because there's no natural tie there.
Yeah, I'm not saying, look, maybe he could have, like, of the guys who have not, you know, like, here's the thing. Some of the coaches that we've all talked about, and look, I think Kirk Ferentz is a terrific coach, but, like, some of the guys that we consider really good coaches, I don't know if they could recruit and kind of work in that environment and thrive, right? I don't know that, Like, you know, you and I both have probably had Pat Fitzgerald as a top 15 coach. I don't know if he could, right? Like last year, I remember I looked back, I had Dan Mullen, I had him ranked 16th. I think you probably had him even higher. Dan Mullen clearly could not, you know, like couldn't thrive in that environment because he imploded at Florida. You know, like I just think there's a lot of pieces that, you know, we don't, you know, I know you were really high on Bill Clark.
Still am.
Jeff Monken. Okay, yeah. Bill Clark and Jeff Monken. I'm not saying if they had those jobs, they wouldn't do well. But you're talking about having to win a national title. And I just think that, like, you know, you look at some of these, you know, Paul Christ. I think he's a really good coach. You know, it's just, I think it's just really, really hard to thrive in those settings where you're operating, you know, it's like...
All right, I'll throw a name at you. Well, first of all, here's one that I definitely think could win it there, but it's not that big a step up from where he is now, and that's Lane Kiffin. Because you're right, the single biggest thing is you can be a great X and O's coach, motivator, whatever. To win a national title, you have to be able to recruit at the same level as Nick Saban. And Kirby has done that. I don't know that many could. All right. Here's a guy who is a good recruiter.
Wait. So you're asking me about Lane Kiffin, or did?
Oh no, I just threw him out. I'm going to assume you agree on that.
Well, I think the challenge here, and this speaks to Kirby, and it definitely speaks, like, I think you have to have a measure of building it and have to have like the infrastructure around, because you can't afford to have a clunker of a couple of games or something, or you know, like a. You have to have some measure of consistency.
Which is why Leach couldn't do it.
Which, yeah, I mean, there's a variety of reasons why I don't think Leach can
do it. All right, here's a guy who has no... Because Lane Kiffin's almost kind of a cop-out because he's already an SEC coach. Here's a guy with no connections to that part of the country or that level of college football. P.J. Fleck. He was number 18 on my top 25 coaches last year. Could P.J. Fleck win a national title if he were the coach of Georgia?
I don't think so.
Really?
No, I don't like. Why do you think he like? I think PJ Fleck could recruit there. I just don't think, like, I don't think his message would play well with that many people there.
At the end of the day, there's a reason they went 41 years without winning one. You know, Mark Richt was a very good coach who couldn't get it done, who couldn't climb that last, you know, rung. He certainly came close a couple times. So, you know, I think you're right. I'm scratching PJ. I'm not putting PJ Fleck on the list. But if I don't put him on there, I don't know how many. I mean, so far we've agreed on one, Lane Kiffin. And surely there's more than
one. I'm not even sure if we agree on Lane. I'm not like, if I go through this
Mark
list.
Stoops. Mark Stoops could do it.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm in my head saying, do I think Mark Stoops would have a better chance than Lane if he was given those kinds of resources? And I think I'm just from a consistency factor, I would say it's possible. I mean, look, Lane is a splashier guy on the recruiting side of things, but it's not like Kirby is a splashy guy at all. Like, the part I wonder about is, could Mark Stoops do exactly what Kirby Smart is? Now, I've never, you know, been in Kirby Smart's meetings. I've heard about him. I don't know. You know, but it's like Lane Kiffin is nothing like Kirby Smart in terms of personality. And so it's like I'm thinking, like, you know, could he do it and make it work?
I don't think it has to be one formula, though. I don't think you have to go in there and do exactly.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
The last three LSU coaches have all won a national title there, and they were none of those guys are very similar different to each other. Yeah,
they are very, very different. Yeah.
But you also don't we haven't even mentioned any mid-major. It's impossible to, like. We're about to find out if Billy Napier is the kind of guy that can win a national title in the SEC.
Like Dave Clawson, I think is a terrific coach. I'm not sure how well Dave Clawson, like, I feel like if you're coaching at Wake Forest is different than if you're coaching at some programs. You're coaching a different kind of athlete.
I think you got to be somebody who even if it's as an assistant, at some point has worked somewhere where you have to recruit five stars. The best of the best.
It's not just the, I think it's something that comes with the five-star player is also, or the high-level recruit is something you are kind of having to constantly work with. And it's not to say that there aren't, you know, immense benefits that come from it. Like, This is a slight tangent here. So when we were all at the coaches convention, I was with a bunch of other reporters, and I remember coming away, like at one point, you know, all the coaches were in the head coaches meeting, or half of them were there. And I remember like walking away, and I was like, I think I had this comment with somebody else. I was like, you know, who's like very, very like has a way that's different from almost everybody in here. And it was Jamie Chadwell. You know, it's like when people are around him, you're like, yeah, I get it. I can totally see why. Like he is, there is just a way about him that, no good. Now look, it may respond to, you know, it's not like I'm an 18-year-old, but like he's somebody where like I could see that guy doing really well. He's obviously a terrific offensive coach. He's had success there. You know, but there aren't a lot of guys where I would, from what I know of them, I'd say, yeah, I think they could, as opposed to when I hear the names like PJ Fleck's a really good coach. I mean, they had a ton of injuries and they still won a bunch of games. I still come back to, you know, maybe it's I've heard too much from other people where it's like you sometimes hear the where the skepticism pops up, whereas a Jamie Chadwell, they're less known, there's less, maybe there's, I don't want to say baggage, but there's less skepticism inherent to that because people just, you know, usually don't know enough. Whereas, you know, sorry, I'm blanking on who asked the question. PJ, what was the guy's name? Chad Justice, where Chad had said, you know, brought up Kirk Ferentz, and you had a fully formed opinion on Kirk Ferentz because he's, you know, he's been there a long time. And I think that adds to it. And I mean, if I were to say, and I don't remember what your list is.
Well, it's going to look a lot different this year.
I'm sure it is. And his mind is going to look a lot different. But I think that there's very, like, I come back to it's incredibly hard to win a national title. There's very few coaches who have done it. I mean, look where we are on Jimbo Fisher. Jimbo Fisher is one of the few guys who's won a national title. What are they, like four now, right now? It's Kirby, Saban, Dabo, and Jimbo. Am I missing anybody? Mack Brown, sorry.
Yes, Mack Brown is the fifth. I knew it was five. I struggled for a second there to remember who the fifth was.
Right, but you know, we come back to Jimbo, and I think, you know, it's weird because he has a national title ring, and he now has a number one ranked class. And you're kind of like, unless you're a diehard Aggie fan, you're just kind of like, all right, you know, he's obviously a really good coach, but you're just still like, you know, so far on the field has not been great at A&M.
Yeah, we're still waiting to see, you know, is history going to show that it was more of a Jameis Winston thing than a Jimbo Fisher thing? We will, I don't know. He's got the number one class in the country, and as you mentioned too earlier, he can even add more to that this week, so... With that comes the expectation of winning a national title. And speaking of big contracts, J.B. Waterman in Venice Beach. I immediately think of J.B. Smoove, but this is J.B. Waterman. Hey, guys, the new trend in top-end college football coach contracts, like Mel Tucker and Jimbo Fisher, is to make them essentially unfireable. With their fully guaranteed 10-year contracts, schools can no longer fire them for losing too many games. It just costs too much. Is this trend going to expand? And do you think it's good for college football to imply that to get a truly great coach, you have to give him an unfireable contract? And he has four question marks after that. So I'm guessing he thinks no. Seems like Jimmy Sexton has too much power. Thanks.
Just to clarify, Jimmy Sexton is Mel Tucker is not a Jimmy Sexton client, but Jimbo Fisher is, and many other guys who have very, very heavy contracts.
Who's Mel Tucker's guy?
Mel Tucker's guy, I believe, is Neil Cornrich.
Okay, so Neil Cornrich is buying a new beach house, thanks to Mel Tucker.
I don't know. Neil Cornrich, I think, is somewhere in Ohio, so I'm not sure if he has a beach house or not. But I, you know, it's always delicate to go too far down the road on what somebody else's money is, because it's ultimately, you know, I think you'd agree with me in saying this. No matter what Nick Saban is paid, Nick Saban is a value and a bargain for
Alabama. Underpaid, drastically underpaid.
Yeah. And so if Jimbo Fisher leads Texas A&M to a national title, by the way, it was reported by our friend Brett McMurphy this week, and maybe this was out there before, but it just dropped, like LSU was offering Jimbo Fisher at one point like a contract that would, I think, almost pay him $16 million a year.
How much?
It was like 15.6 or 15.8, like one of the years. It wasn't the average of the contract, but there was a year where that was going to be it way. But the money was absurd money. And if, again, if Jimbo Fisher leads Texas A&M to a national title, this is a program that, by the way, like in Sumlin's first year in the SEC, they finished top five. It was like the first time in 50 years they had that, or maybe the second time. It was just like, that is a program that is starving for high level success and hasn't, and has a lot of people with big money who are really engaged. Michigan State, the crazy thing about Mel Tucker is he's had one winning season as a head coach. You know, and it's like, no, you and I both think he's done a really good job.
I think it's important to point out, because before we start trying to turn this into a trend, is the very unusual circumstance of Mel Tucker's contract, which is that basically one guy is funding it. One extremely rich booster who, what's that guy's background? How'd he get rich?
Ahmad Ishbia. Yeah.
He's a former Michigan State basketball player.
He was a walk-on basketball player. I don't know where his money comes from.
Yeah, so not every school has that. And, you know, that's great for him and for Mel Tucker that he wants to make that happen. Sorry, it's two guys. Matt, how do you say his name?
Ishbia
and Steve St. Andre, who are fully funding the entire $95 million contract. So, I mean, to say this is going to become the norm, I mean, to make that happen, you're going to need some crazy, crazy boosters. And so, you know, and James Franklin obviously is getting a huge contract as well. But I think it's going to be pretty rare to get that kind of contract. Now, I would say what would be nice for college football and stability is if there was something in between these insane 10-year fully guaranteed contracts and paying guys $20, $30 million buyouts to go away. You know, there's no in between there. It's either the $7, $15, $16, $17 million buyout or $95 million buyout.
Yeah, you're right. And it's like, it that is the business, right? I mean, there's a lot of crazy stuff that happens in coaching, in the coaching world, but at the top of the food chain, and that varies a little bit from where it is. Obviously, Michigan State has moved to that because of a couple of very significant boosters. What a difference a year makes there.
It's a completely irrational market. It's based on, in many cases, you know, one rich guy or two rich guys really want to win the national championship. Last one from Mark in Pittsburgh. It's about North Dakota State, which has now won 9 of the last 11 FCS championships. Is there any talk of them making the jump up to FBS football like Sam Houston State and James Madison? Would they immediately be a top team in the Mountain West, or is the gap between FCS and Group of Five teams bigger than it seems? You've actually not heard, I don't know about you, I've never heard any momentum for that. You know, a lot of these FCS teams want desperately to move up to FBS. I've never heard that about North Dakota State.
Yeah, and they're in the best FCS league in the Missouri Valley. And from what I've heard, that they're comfortable where they're at. And I do think they would be one of the best group of five programs if they have. I mean, I remember talking to a coach who was in the MAC. This is a long time ago. This is probably like 7 or 8 years ago. And he was like, they're better than a lot of Power Five programs. And at that point, I think they had just beaten like maybe K-State, and they had, you know, it's like you see it because they have a lot of, you know, physically developed players. They recruit to it. They develop players. And then the other thing I think is key is they've been very smart in how their evaluation is. I remember the longtime quarterback coach there was telling me the story about how he found Trey Lance. Obviously, he deserves a lot of credit because there's a ton of Big Ten schools that missed, and Trey Lance ended up being a top 10 pick, you know. And so I think they've been very shrewd in their evaluations over a long period of time. They have an identity. They know what it is, and they recruit to it. And so, you know, like at this point, and again, I mean, he mentions like Sam Houston's really good, you know, and they've been good for a while. They have a really good offense. I think the head coach there has won he's won national titles before, and he's a really good coach, Casey Keeler. And I think that they you know, they're in a very fertile recruiting area too, by the way.
I think, I don't know exactly how you would quantify, like if they took their current team and put them in FBS, where they would rank, but I would imagine it would be in the upper half. I think they're definitely better than some Power Five programs. How many, I don't know. I think they would be an immediate contender in a conference like the Mountain West. What I don't know is what do you make of, they can only give 63 scholarships to 85 in the FBS. Would that, if they were playing a full, it's easy for us to say like talent wise, right? They're right there. But depth wise, if the last 22 on there are walk-ons, you know, you would think the depth would catch up to them at some point. So they would have to immediately go, you know, offer a whole lot of kids to get up to 85.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like they have a really good programs developmental wise. I use this example because it's like I saw it up close and personal. Like one season, it was in 2019. Our crew kicked off the year at Minnesota, and we saw South Dakota State, which is a rival of North Dakota State, and they're very good, but they're not North Dakota State. They played Minnesota at Minnesota and should have probably won the game. They were leading it at one point. They ended up losing. That was a really good, I think the final score, they lost by a touchdown. But that was a team that ended up winning. It was a top 10 Minnesota team. You know, they were 11-2 that year. And I don't think, like, do I think if they played 10 times, South Dakota State would win more than three? Probably not. But South Dakota State went toe-to-toe with them. There was, like, nothing fluky about it. You know, guys on that South Dakota State team are now in the NFL, right? And
you can win a lot of those one-off games. But
there was no, like, tricky stuff with it. It was, like, they were a physical team, and they had guys who, like, the – head coach at Idaho now was the offensive coordinator at South Dakota State. And so he was a former Big Ten lineman, and we talked a bunch, and he was like, yeah, he was kind of going through his offensive line. And there were guys who were like 6'6", 225 when they're in high school. Well, now they're 6'6", 305. And they were guys who should be probably in the Big Ten, except the Big Ten is usually not taking developmental guys necessarily. They'll take the bigger guy and then they'll ride it out. Whereas a lot of these programs, and there's a bunch of them. Like, I've had these guys back-to-back years on my freaks list. Spencer Brown was one where they are guys who end up in the Missouri Valley where they were – some of these guys grew up on farms. They were very raw but still very athletic, great work ethic guys, and they end up developing into high-round draft picks. It's not that uncommon that this has happened now. We've seen it happen time and time again. And I think you see that a lot in the Missouri Valley. You see it a lot where, you know, there's a kid who falls through the cracks. Like, again, the running back who South Dakota State had, Pierre Strong, the Senior Bowl guys at midseason thought he was the most talented senior running back in the country. You know, and he was a guy who's from Arkansas, kind of fell through the cracks, ended up there. And, you know, that happens a bunch. You know, as much as, and this is not to, like, you know, to poke Ari on the Stars Matter kind, but there's just I want to say this because I feel like it gets misinterpreted a lot or distorted. It's not to say that the stars don't matter. It's to say that there's a lot of really good football players who just get missed in the process, and they end up at places like this and they flourish. And I think that oftentimes they don't get the credit because people just missed on them or just missed them, or maybe they're late bloomers.
I think we're both saying the same thing in different ways. They have lots and lots of great players at North Dakota State, and because of that, they can beat probably 2/3 or more of the teams in FBS. If they were playing a full 12-game schedule against FBS teams, just like any team, they're going to have injuries. Injuries are going to mount. Are the backups or the second, third string guys at North Dakota State able to step in and play right away at that level? That I don't know. I'm skeptical of that. But obviously, if they became an FBS member, they would immediately be able to recruit to that. Also, however, I might be wrong on that, and here's why. Even though they can only offer 63 full scholarships, they can actually do partial scholarships the way college baseball does, a lot of other sports. So, like, I'm just looking this up now. North Dakota State signed 31 guys this year. Clearly, if there were only 63 scholarships available, they wouldn't be able to do that. So some of those guys are, they're spreading those around as partial scholarships. So it may well be that they've got 85 legit FBS caliber players. They're just not all on full scholarship. All right. That was a nice, I can't remember the last time we went that in depth on mailbag questions.
All right. Well, as always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and we will see you next time.